In many ways, the gathering of a church on the first day of the week is much like a complex crossroads, in that people are coming from all sorts of directions. And I don't mean by that north, south, east, west, southeast, northeast, whatever. I don't even mean coming from different backgrounds, cultures, races, ethnics, economic class, education classes. Really, we all come from different perspectives and backgrounds and experiences. And the point is that we all should be coming toward God. In a gathering like this, there is a diversity of people coming from different directions. But the point of this gathering is that we focus on God. And that's the most important thing to unite us, in that we listen to God and that we help each other in doing that. And so thank you for being here, every one of you. And even if you're here just for today, thank you for being here. And may we all gather together and look at God and now listen to God. So I've seen this so many times when I've watched a sporting event, especially if it was a championship sporting event. It's a big game. And they're interviewing one of the winners and maybe one of the key players of the game. And they will ask the person a question like, you know, how'd your team do it? Or what was the important play? And sometimes the first person the person will say is, well, the first thing I want to do is give credit to God. Glory to God for this great thing that's happened to me. I think a lot of religious people are like, yeah, that's great. That's cool. You know what I've never seen? I've never seen the loser be interviewed and say, well, things didn't turn out the way I wanted them to. I didn't have a very good game, but I give God all glory and I thank Him. You don't hear that. Why? Well, today is our monthly lesson on the prophets. We're doing so many different things, reading through the prophets this year and classes. And about once a month, I do a sermon extracted from around about the point where we've been reading or about to read. And this morning, our attention turns to Habakkuk. We've done several things on Wednesday night on Habakkuk, including one survey summary class. But I want us to focus on a particular part of this book this morning. So turn with me to Habakkuk, starting in chapter 1, though most of our attention will be on the third chapter. In Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 6, we see the setting, the event, the circumstance that prompts this prophecy. This is the Lord speaking through the prophet. And he says this in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 6. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. Chaldeans, these were the people who were the ruling ethnic class in the Neo-Babylonian Empire. In other words, the Babylonians, led by King Nebuchadnezzar. They became very rapidly a mighty invading force, a mighty empire. They didn't last very long, but they were powerful. And what God speaks here is that He is raising them up, and they're going to march through the earth and seize that which is not their own. This will include Judah, the homeland of Habakkuk. And even though this invasion would be a few decades away, Habakkuk's prophecy is previewing, telling us that it's coming, telling the people then that it was coming. And Habakkuk becomes involved in this announcement that they're coming, and he's struggling with this news. And this prophecy not only includes the news of what God will do, But in this wise manner, this divinely inspired book also presents Habakkuk's struggle with the whole thing. And so that's why we find in chapter 1, verse 13, Habakkuk saying, "You are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong." Habakkuk is speaking to God here, and he's saying to God, "You're pure. You can't even have anything to do with evil." And then he asks the question, "Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he?" Habakkuk fully understood that Judah had been unfaithful to the Lord. He is too righteous of a man, too astute of a man not to have seen that Judah was guilty before God. But why must God use Babylon to punish Judah? This fearsome, violent, arrogant, and I think it's fair to take it at face value, in some way, a nation more wicked than Judah, although that's a pretty low bar at this time. Here's what God does in this book. He doesn't give Habakkuk what he wants. He doesn't go into a detailed explanation. You know, we do that sometimes. Somebody challenges us what we're doing. And even if we have a very good reason to do it, we're like, well, you have to understand this, you have to understand that. And we give this whole catalog of reasons why we're doing something. God doesn't do it. He doesn't have to. He's God. He does, however, speak of how Babylon and other ungodly nations would eventually be judged. Oh, don't think they're going to get, you know, left off the hook here. He will judge them. And by the time we get to really this third chapter, this end of the prophecy, you see that Habakkuk accepts what God's going to do. Read with me in chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. It starts off with a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, according to Shiganeoth. So this is a part of the prophecy where Habakkuk is speaking to God. But this is part of the divine record to teach us and to give us insight regarding the journey that Habakkuk had made. "O Lord," he says in verse 2, "I've heard the report of you and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy." What you see here is that Habakkuk accepts the work of God. You've got work to do, God, and you're going to do it. Just remember in your wrath, mercy. Habakkuk is resolved to this. We're going to see how there are two important things to which Habakkuk is resolved. In other words, he accepts it. And not just like giving in, okay, I know that's going to happen, okay, I know, but he embraces it. And what's happening in this prayer, and this is such masterful literature, is that you've got this emphasis and you've got this roar of a message here for verse after verse after verse that we're about to read, and then you have this little statement at the end, this punctuation at the end that's really brief. It's really more powerful than all the thunder that went before. Speaking of thunder, what we'll now read in Habakkuk 3, starting in verse 9, is Habakkuk's description of what God's going to do when he starts punishing evil nations like Babylon. Habakkuk 3, verse 9. Let's take this line by line. "You strip the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows." God is depicted as a warrior here, about to go to war against evil nations. He's going to unleash his judgment. A bow would be carried in a sheath, probably a leather sheath. It's like putting a sword in a sheath. It's the idea of, he pulls it out. And then he says, "Give me many arrows." He's about to unleash on them. The end of verse 9. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging water swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted up its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows as they sped. At the flash of your glittering spear. This is poetic language. This is figurative. And what's depicted here is that earth is going to go through cataclysmic convulsions when God unleashes his wrath. The mountains, the rivers, in the wake of his judgment, the earth is going to shake. Verse 12, you march through the earth in fury. You thresh the nations in anger. This right here, way more the Babylonians than the Assyrians. Then centuries later, Alexander's armies. Then a few centuries later, the Roman army. And many centuries later, the Mongol army. And many centuries later, the Nazi war machine. And on and on and on. This right here is the most fierce army ever known to human existence. It's God. Verse 13. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. Ultimately, in the end, when all is said and done, this wrath of God is not just going to be a punishment upon the wicked. It's going to be for the deliverance, for the benefit, for the salvation of God's people. The end of verse 13. You crush the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. That is a depiction of striking the top and the whole system collapsing. And even the idea of laying him bare from thigh to neck. I think most likely what this means, it's like taking a dagger and sticking it in someone's thigh, you know, where there are a major artery, and then cutting up through his body all the way up through the neck. Like butchering someone. Are you a little rattled yet? You ought to be. This is brutal language. Verse 14. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. How fitting. And it's always that way when God executes his punishment, when God executes his judgment. It is always fitting. It is poetic. There are ironies involved. With his own arrows, you're going to take him out. Verse 15. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of many waters. What would happen, and in ancient times, there's no more fierce military force than one with horses, especially horses and chariots. What would happen if you took a large force and ran them into the sea? Well, they'd sink, right? They'd perish. They would flounder. We have the account of Pharaoh's mighty army running into the dry bed of the Red Sea, and then the waters collapsing on top of them. Even a mighty cavalry force can't cut through a sea. But this is depicting God's army that cuts through the sea like it's a mud puddle. Mud puddles and ditches and creeks are nothing for an invading cavalry force. And that's the picture. This is so disturbing that in spite of the fact that Habakkuk knows that the Babylonians are and will be evil, violent people who deserve punishment, this even rattles Habakkuk. Verse 16, I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones and my legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. even those that are they're so ungodly and deserve God's wrath, Habakkuk is left trembling. And did you catch what he said at the end of verse 16? I mean, this is Habakkuk describing the man who's troubled that Babylon would be so victorious in their conquest. And now he gets a picture of how Babylon and other evil nations will be devoured by the wrath of God. Did you catch what he said at the end of verse 16? That this is going to come upon the people who invade us. You see, Babylon's going to be judged by God. But so will Judah. By the people, the Babylonians, who will experience this judgment of chapter 3. God's going to punish Judah through Babylon, and then God in his way will punish Babylon. Historically, he will do that with the invasion of the Medes and the Persians. God is going to punish both Judah and Babylon. They will not escape invasion. The nightmare that Habakkuk and the other people of Judah feared will become a reality. Some will perish. Some will be dragged into Babylonian captivity. Some will be oppressed in that captivity. And some, a remnant, will survive that captivity and come back home. But in spite of the fact that Habakkuk knows they're still going to be invaded, look what he writes in verse 17, 18, and 19. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fell and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places to the choir master with stringed instruments. It is true when Babylon would invade Judah one day, crops would likely be stripped and destroyed, the livestock plundered, a lot of it probably slaughtered on the spot. But I suspect that this is more figurative language, indicating for this agrarian society that was built around raising animals and crops, that the point is, if my daily life is stripped, if my provisions are yanked away from me, if my daily life is void of earthly good, I will still rejoice in the Lord. I will depend on Him. And I will allow His strength to lift me up to a higher plane. Habakkuk, you see, is resolved to what's going to happen. But he's also resolved in his faith. Habakkuk, writing for the people, writes the right perspective, the perspective these people need to have in a few years. And that is, they can't expect to be delivered from Babylonian captivity, but they can expect to be delivered through these terrible events. Okay, what about us? Do you have that kind of resolve? We students of the life of Jesus are leery of a disciple who would defiantly declare that they would never forsake the Lord, because we remember Peter. Peter made a fickle declaration hours before Jesus was taken into custody, that no matter what happened, he'd never forsake Jesus. And then hours later, he denied him. Take heed lest you fall, right? So we're a little hesitant about ahead of time declaring what we'll do and not do. It's understandable. But is there not a place for resolved faith like Habakkuk's? Though this may happen, and this may happen, and this may happen, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Is it better to think, well, you know, I don't know what's going to happen and some bad things may happen. And if they do, I don't want to be presumptuous. And so I'm just going to wait and see. And I may stick with the Lord and I may not. I just don't know. Is that the approach? You know, we sometimes advise young people about certain moral dangers and we tell them, whether it's sexual danger or substance abuse or getting with the wrong crowd and getting involved in criminal activity or something, we'll say, you know, you got to make a decision ahead of time. You're not going to do that. And that's wise counsel. Would not a decision now be a good idea? Well, like Habakkuk's. Or do we, even maybe without realizing it, have a conditional faith? People sometimes say things like, well, you know, God's been so good to me. You know, I got that job right when I needed a good job, and I found a great deal on the house, and our family's been so healthy even after Junior had a little bout of a disease, but he's healthy now and a growing boy, and God is so good, and I have so much love and trust for him. That's legitimate. We should see how God's blessed us and helped us. How about this? I lost my job at the worst time. Right when Junior got sick and we don't know if he's ever going to get better. And it looks like we're going to have to sell the house because we can't make the mortgage payment now. But I trust God and I love him and I'm going to stick with him. Is that legitimate? Do our trappings and circumstances prop up our faith? What Habakkuk depicts is that all the trappings are going to get knocked out. And then what? What Habakkuk depicts here is a faith that transcends one's situation and survives alone when everything else is lost. The prophets are not for people with feeble minds, weak hearts, and sensitive stomachs spiritually. This is the big boy and the big girl stuff right here. We don't know what the future holds, do we? We don't know how life's going to go for us. But we can safely assume something. We're going to face trials. If we think we're going to get through life without trials, we're kidding ourselves. It's probable that none of us will go through an experience like the invasion of the Babylonian army and the captivity into Babylon. That's something like that probably is not going to happen to us. But do we realize what could happen? You read about things like at the first of the century of the Spanish flu, which is misnamed because it didn't start in Spain. We know that now. But thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people in Europe and in the United States died on the ending of the First World War after all that catastrophe. And then all these people, just almost every family was affected by it. Then you go further back and you read about the bubonic plague of the late Middle Ages, where it's estimated somewhere around 25% of the total population of Europe perished. In some communities, upwards as 50% of the people died. And you read about those things and they sound like, you know, fantasy literature. And we forget that just a few years ago that in certain urban areas, trailer morgues were having to be set up because bodies were piling up so fast they couldn't get them buried fast enough. Have you ever read stories from 2007 about the Great Recession? Now, for a lot of people, it looks like just a bump in the road. Oh, you don't know the story, do you? Did you know in 2007, the entire banking system almost collapsed in the United States? But secretly, there were people calling their wives and saying, get down to the bank and take every dollar you can out in cash. Got pretty close. Some say regarding this quote connected to the Titanic disaster that it's a myth. Even if it is partially, it represents exactly what a lot of people were thinking. And I would do have to say, though, it is listed, it is quoted in two of the standard works on the Titanic, Walter Lord's book in the 1950, and then Butler's book in 2012, an excellent book called Unsinkable. It's a story of a Mrs. Caldwell who's getting on the ship in England, in Southampton. And there was a crew member helping her with her bags. And she said, young man, I hear that this ship is unsinkable. I mean, that's what was being touted. Maybe not using that word, but in essence, when you heard what the shipbuilder said about it and what the press was saying about it, people's conclusion was it was unsinkable. And the young crew member told Mrs. Caldwell, ma'am, not even God himself can sink this ship. Never made it to North America, did it? Today it sits at the bottom of the North Atlantic. Do we think such things can never happen in our lifetime? Do we not realize that we live in a frail world and we live in such fragile bodies? We need to realize that every single thing that is earthly and physical, that gives us security and comfort, can be lost. And then there are the personal catastrophes. Habakkuk is set to the backdrop of a national catastrophe, the invasion of the Babylonians into Judah. And we've referenced some other group catastrophes in those illustrations, but always built within group catastrophes or personal catastrophes. And sometimes when the world is just ticking along fine as it can please, individuals have catastrophes. Of which some of you know firsthand or through close acquaintances. Habakkuk was resolved to two things. The trial of the Babylonian invasion is going to happen. He knows it's going to happen because he can even see through the Spirit how God's going to punish the Babylonians when it's done. But he also knew that they were going to invade Judah. But the other thing to which he was resolved was his faith in God. Our great challenge is not to find a way to avoid trials. Oh, it doesn't mean that we don't put a seatbelt on. It doesn't mean we don't go to the doctor and we're feeling a pain in our back. That's not what I'm talking about. It's just a vain venture to think that we're going to avoid them completely. But our challenge is to have a resolve in our faith that when trials come, we still find joy in the Lord and rely on Him for His strength. Consider how Habakkuk helps us to have the right perspective in this in three ways. First of all, if we can see that our losses are not the losses they appear to be. Captivity would seem like the end of the world. You know how long the nation of Israel had been around at this point? About 700 years. Living in this land as an independent nation for the most part. 700 years. Makes the United States look like a toddler. And then it all collapses. And in these prophetic writings, like Isaiah, that we've been studying on Sunday morning, what Isaiah is trying to get us to see, get the writers to see, is that this is going to be catastrophic, but this is going to lead to the great work of God of restoring and redeeming all people through the Messiah. That's why the latter chapters of Isaiah are just laced with messianic prophecies. It's not what's just going to happen, which is going to be terrible. It's what is also going to happen. It's where it will lead eventually. And that is to God's great deliverance. And this is not a matter of not feeling the pain of trials and getting hurt by loss. I suppose there are some religious people who would give you the idea that, well, if you have faith in God, then no matter what happens, if you go bankrupt or you're family is hit by, crashes in an airplane accident, or everything's fine, just smile, it's okay. Of course not. Oh, well, my child died, we'll be okay. No big deal. That's unnatural. It's unhealthy. It's artificial. No, life hurts. We get bruises, we bleed, we hurt. It is feeling the burdens and pain of trials and loss, but knowing that's not the end. That's not the only thing. Suppose a man has a brand new car. He's always wanted this car. So I'm not that into cars, okay? They're cool. But if you just love cars, you got one. So plug in your favorite car, okay, into this illustration. But he's got this car. He's saved for it. It's just the best one. I mean, it's sharp. It's got all the gadgets. It's wonderful. He's so excited about this car. So he loads his family in the car and they take a vacation. And about 2 hours down the road, he has a flat. He runs over something and he causes a flat. And he's like, okay, everybody pile out. And they pile out and they pull the luggage out of the trunk so they can get to the spare. And he has the kids and his wife to carry the luggage over the guardrail on the other side of the guardrail, which is what you're supposed to do, on the other side of the guardrail. And he gets out there and he starts changing this flat tire. And his wife goes, look out. And he looks up and he sees a semi truck barreling out of control down the interstate. And so he leaps over the guardrail to safety. And that semi just plows into that car like it's made by Matchbox. It just shreds that car and flattens it. So he sees that mangled car, but there on the other side of the guardrail is his wife and children, safe and sound. That's awful to have your car wiped out like that, especially one that you just bought new and you wanted to have it. But your wife and your kids, they're fine. We're going to have loss, but do we have the right perspective? Whatever we may suffer and lose, and it may be grave, if we walk with God, we won't lose Him. We won't lose salvation in Him. No matter what we may have to experience. And that He writes about the joy of the Lord and rejoicing in the Lord. Recall in John chapter 14, the night that Jesus was arrested and he's beginning to meet with his apostles, or he eats the Passover with them, etc. And they know. They're so troubled. They don't understand so many things, but they know something bad is looming. And he says in John 14, verse 1, let not your hearts be troubled. They know they're entering into a dark tunnel here. And there are going to be scary noises. And he's trying to comfort them. And then he says over in chapter 16, verse 22, so also you have sorrow now. He's speaking of leaving them. And it troubles them. And in a matter of hours, as the next 10 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours click off, they are going to be devastated. They're going to be so sorrowful. Consider what's about to happen. Jesus is going to be arrested. He's going to be falsely accused. He's going to be manhandled and roughed up. He's going to be dragged in front of a crowd before the ruling seat of Pilate. He's going to be slandered. They're going to take him and scourge him. They're going to bring him back in a humiliating parade. The people are going to be manipulated by the leaders, and they're going to call for his death. And then he's going to be taken to Calvary, and he's going to be executed in the most horrific way. All this terrible stuff's going to happen. And it's going to leave over the next 2 days. It's going to leave these disciples disillusioned and troubled, brokenhearted, confused. They don't know where to step, if even to step at all. Jesus says in 16:22, before it all happens, see also you have sorrow now, but I will see you again. He's going to resurrect after all that and appear to them. And your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. Oh, but we know from the book of Acts and the letters of the New Testament that this is not the end of the sorrow for these apostles. When they take up the mission of proclaiming Christ's gospel to the world, they're going to be maligned, they're going to be slandered, they're going to lose goods, they're going to be beaten up, they're going to be condemned, they're going to be thrown in jail, and eventually most of them put to death. But Christ speaks of something here. A joy you can't lose. Let us understand that this is a joy of the most deepest nature. This is the kind of joy that you can have in spite of being beaten and thrown in jail for Christ. This is a deep thing because it's connected to deep faith. That when the world is melting around you, that inside of you, there is this solace and comfort and peace because we still trust in the Lord. This is a faith that says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Habakkuk 3:18. Yet. For Habakkuk's people, it would be the devastation of Babylonian invasion and captivity. Yet, though this happens, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. What's my yet? What's my though? I've thought a little bit about that. I don't know whether it's healthy or not. I think it has something to do with my personality and probably not all that great aspect of it, but sometimes I think about terrible things that could happen. I think that could become crippling to a person. We have to keep that under control. But there's a healthy element too. When I hear about the diagnosis that some people get, when I hear about someone losing a child or a spouse, or I hear about something disastrous that happens to them, sometimes I wonder, well, what if that happened to me? What would I do? How would I handle that? Would I still believe in the God of my salvation? Would I still find joy in the Lord? It would behoove me to answer that question and answer it now. What is your yet? What is your though? And how will you respond? And thirdly, do we make the Lord our only true and everlasting strength? Habakkuk depicts the Lord as his strength when he is describing a situation where everything that people in agrarian society would depict as their strength was stripped away from them. In other words, when you got nothing, what do you have? What Habakkuk says is, the Lord, he's my strength. We modern Americans are people of vast resources. It's in the annals of time, it's remarkable what's at our disposal. And even compared to other contemporaries in this world, it's amazing what's at our disposal. Financially, medically, the information, we got a pill and we got an app for everything. Right? Wrong. We may claim to have a pill or an app for it, but we can't deliver ourselves from everything that troubles us. Is it possible that we pray for God to help us with this or that, but then we say amen, and then we go out to fix our problem ourselves, thinking we've got to fix it ourselves, and we're going to fix it ourselves? What is your true strength? Where does your strength lie? What gives you comfort and security? Is it your talents, your money, your connections, your position, your health, your family? Did you know you can lose every bit of that? It's possible. Habakkuk teaches us to make the Lord our strength. And he's so strong. Think about this idea of strength. That the Lord is so strong that, as Habakkuk writes in verse 19, he makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Remember the context. He's saying this in light of the end of verse 16, where he references invasion. That your feet can be as fast and light as a deer's and you can soar at high places? Really? How does this line up with going through that? Well, we're all familiar with superheroes. The ancients had them in their myths, their god myths about gods and so forth. We have them in our modern times. And one of the characteristics of a superhero is that they can fly or run in with flashing speeds, or they have special abilities or even special vehicles and tools that can move faster, and they're stronger than anything else, and they can swoop in when mayhem breaks out and they can snatch us up and rescue us. The person is in a burning building and it's about to collapse, and Flash, this is in Los Angeles, and Flash is in New York. And he hears about it, and he runs in there and he grabs the person out of the building and pulls them out before the building collapses. He just swoops them out. The bomb is about to blow up, and the heroine is tied to a stake beside the bomb. And Superman swoops in from 5,000 feet in the sky and 5,000 miles away. And he swoops in and grabs her in his arm. You know, he's always got one arm here. Like he's got to have that out. And he swoops her up and he soars above the explosion. And it's like a firecracker that pops and they're safe up in the sky. All fantasy. If you're ever in a burning building, Flash is not going to come. If you're ever tied next to a bomb, Superman's not going to swoop in. There is no superpower we can access on earth, and none within ourselves. But there is a superpower. The true power. The great strength of the Lord. That can help us run and even soar when all the world's collapsing. And it's not that our physical bodies can rise above and be spared physical trial, loss, and suffering. It's in our inner being. It's our soul. In our soul, we can run and soar, and we can rise above and get through whatever trial, suffering, or loss we may have to face. And we can keep moving onward and upward. This is how Paul put it in 2 Corinthians 4 and in verse 16. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. Oh, what Habakkuk teaches us is that we can get through anything if we make the Lord our strength and ever rejoice in Him. Well, Brother Darrell's going to come and lead us in another hymn. And as we sing this song together, sort of like Habakkuk, you know, he's got a song for us to sing. As we sing this song together, will you contemplate what trials you may have to face and whether the Lord is in your life or not? And if He's not, then the gospel call is open. And if you understand who Jesus is and you believe He is the Christ, the Son of God, and if you choose to turn from sin and walk with Him, you can soar. No matter what mayhem may be incurring around you. And today, that walk and that flight can start after you're baptized into Christ and you're raised to walk in newness of life. If you need to respond to the gospel, won't you do that as we stand and sing?